Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. Our featured story this month is by one of our magazine's longtime fiction contributors and translators, Josh Pachter, a winner of the Edward D. Hoke Memorial Golden Derringer for Lifetime Achievement in 2020 from the Short Mystery Fiction Society. Josh first appeared in our magazine as a fiction writer when he was still in high school. Here he is reading his story, The City of Light, from the March-April 2020 issue of EQMM.
When Kathleen breezed in to apologize, "We just found out, Mom. Apple's taking us over, so things are completely insane. I'm so sorry, but I've got to cancel." Elizabeth McIntyre's first instinct was to delay their trip yet again. She'd already booked their flights and hotel reservations twice, though, both times thanks to insane developments at her daughter's demanding IT job. As it was, she had mixed emotions about the trip, but the need for a final resolution after all these years outweighed her hesitation. And at the age of 72, Elizabeth knew that her window of opportunity was closing. Plus, honestly, it would be much easier for her to do what had to be done without Kathleen at her side. Since her outbound flight was a red eye, at least Kathleen was available to pick her up on Monday, April 15th, and take her from her Falls Church condo to Dulles. After a warm curbside goodbye, Elizabeth checked her wheelie bag through to her final destination, endured the usual TSA screening, rode the aero train to Concourse B, and sat patiently at her gate until it was time to board Lufthansa's LH415 to Munich. The plane took off at 10:30 p.m., right on time, and touched down at Franz Josef Strauss Airport 8 hours later, at 12:42 p.m. local time, a few minutes ahead of schedule. At the Flughafen, she whiled away her three-hour layover, sipping strong coffee and nibbling at an overcooked bratwurst and leafing through a copy of the London Times some previous passenger had left behind. LH-2234, her connecting flight, landed at Charles de Gaulle at 5:15. She stowed her Kindle in her capacious handbag, thanked the attendant and pilot, who stood smiling and nodding at the head of the aisle, and shuffled along with the crowd of deplaning travelers to immigration, where she told the officer, "Pleasure," and "1 week," and the name of her hotel. She collected her wheelie bag from the carousel and went through the nothing-to-declare lane without incident. At 6:35, she was in the back seat of a black taxi on the Périphérique, crawling through rush-hour traffic when the news came over the radio. The French she'd picked up during her one previous visit to Paris, a study abroad trip during the spring semester of her junior year at Middlebury College, fully half a century ago, had long since deserted her. But she recognized the words Notre-Dame, and when her driver exhaled a stunned Mon Dieu, and she asked him what had happened, he explained as best he could in his halting English. "La cathédrale," he said, "the cathedral, Notre-Dame, you know it? She is, how do you say it, she burns." They exited onto the Avenue de la Grande Armée at last and drove southeast, looped around the Arc de Triomphe, then south on the Avenue Marceau and east on the Cours Albert Premier, parallel to the Seine. When they crossed the Pont de la Concorde at 7:12, her cabbie pointed off to his left, and she could see a plume of black smoke rising in the distance. The Rue de Lille was barricaded, so they had to detour down the Boulevard Saint-Germain, then up the Rue du Pré-Auclair. It was 7:24 by the time they pulled in before the Hôtel Université in the Rue de l'Université. The driver lifted her wheelie bag from the trunk of the cab, and she paid him and thanked him and went into the hotel. "Have you heard?" the receptionist, whose nameplate identified him as Rino, asked her. "Yes," she said, "but only that there's a fire. What's happening? Is it terrorists?" "Anne Hidalgo, the mayor, was just on the television. She says the firefighters think it started because of the renovations, but they don't know for sure. It's terrible, she says. They don't know if they'll be able to save it. As he checked her in, they commiserated over the loss of such an irreplaceable piece of the city's skyline. And then Elizabeth took the rickety elevator up to the third floor and found her room and unpacked. She hung her sweaters and blouses and skirts in the wardrobe, laid her undergarments and stockings in the bureau drawers, arranged her toiletries on the glass shelf above the sink in the small bathroom. She unscrewed the top from a can of talcum powder and emptied the contents into a Ziploc baggie she'd packed for just this purpose. She was gratified to see that the little glass vial of fine white crystals had made the long journey intact. She refilled the talcum can halfway, pressed the vial back in place, and buried it beneath the rest of the powder. Elizabeth had gotten very little sleep on the transatlantic flight, had dozed only briefly on the hop from Germany to France. The two meals she'd been served had been surprisingly palatable, so she wasn't hungry. But she was exhausted and would have liked nothing better than to go straight to bed. With Notre Dame ablaze, though, she knew that sleep would be impossible. Instead, she took a quick shower to refresh herself as best she could, put on clean clothes, and went back out into the city. She turned left outside the hotel and walked up to the Rue de Saint-Père, which took her to the Quai Voltaire. She crossed at the crosswalk and joined the crowd at the Place Justin Godard, overlooking the river. She would have liked to have gotten closer to the Île de la Cité, but the streets were impassable. Even at this distance, however, she could see the flames. It was 8:15 p.m., and the cathedral's spire was already gone. A man beside her was watching a news broadcast on his tablet. Elizabeth looked over his shoulder and saw the French Prime Minister, Emmanuel Macron. She tugged at the man's sleeve. "Parlez-vous anglais?" she said. "Oh, oui," he said. "Yes, I do." "What's he saying?" "He says that Notre Dame has fallen, oh, what's the word, has fallen prey to the fire. Like all my countrymen," he says, "I am désolé. I grieve to see this part of our history burning." "Oh, mon Dieu," she said, unconsciously echoing her cab driver's horror. She thanked the man and watched for another few minutes. When the fatigue became impossible to ignore any longer, she walked back to the hotel and went up to her room, stripped off her clothing, and not even bothering to put on her nightgown, fell into bed. When she awoke, Elizabeth experienced a moment of confusion, uncertain at first where she was. The mattress on which she had slept was soft, so this surely wasn't her home. She opened her eyes and looked around the unfamiliar room, and then it came back to her. She was in Paris, back at last after all the intervening years, back to take care of the business she had left unfinished. She found her glasses on the nightstand beside the bed and put them on, found her wristwatch and saw that it was nearly noon. She had slept for almost 15 hours. She got out of bed and showered and dressed and went down to the lobby. It was too late for le petit déjeuner, and the hotel didn't serve lunch, but there was a basket of apples at the front desk, and the receptionist, a new one now, Marie Claire, a friendly woman in perhaps her late 40s, Kathleen's age, fixed her a cappuccino while bringing her up to date on the fire. Though the spire and the main roof and the 13th-century interior wooden latticework known as the forest, so-called because of the 13,000 already ancient oaks that had been felled to construct it, were gone. The crown of thorns and the contents of the treasury, all three of the rose windows and the organ with its 8,000 pipes, even the 16 9-foot copper statues of the 12 apostles and 4 evangelists had been spared. And miraculously, as if by some divine intervention, not a single life had been lost. Not a single life lost, Elizabeth thought, remembering the years she herself had lost after she had left Paris long ago, remembering the reason for her return. But it was no use dwelling on that. There was nothing she could do about it until the evening, so she forced her mind elsewhere. "What about the bees?" she asked. She had read somewhere that there were beehives on the roof of the cathedral above the sacristy, just beneath the largest of the rose windows. "The bees?" asked Marie-Claire, not recognizing the word. Elizabeth fluttered her hands by the sides of her head and made a buzzing noise. "Oh, la la!" the receptionist exclaimed. "Les abeilles!" The bees, it seemed, had also survived. All 180,000 of them, 60,000 in each of three hives. The hives had been established some 30 meters below the cathedral's main roof, and they had not been touched by the blaze. Elizabeth drank her cappuccino and left the hotel, tried once again to get a first-hand look at what remained of Notre Dame. This time, she was able to draw closer. But beginning with the Pont Neuf, all five of the bridges leading from the left bank to the Île de la Cité were cordoned off. The air was heavy with the stink of burnt wood, and the roads and sidewalks were coated with a sludge of drenched ash. That sludge, she realized, was surely contaminated with lead from the cathedral's roof, and the lead levels in the air must also be significantly higher than was normal. She doubted there would be much of an impact on tourists who were only in Paris for short periods of time, but she wondered if the city authorities were taking steps to safeguard the health of the people, especially the children, who lived and worked in the area. She turned back, strolled along the embankment, with the bulk of the Louvre looming across the dark water of the Seine to her right. The Pont du Carrousel was open, so she could have crossed it and gone either right into the city's most famous art museum or left into the Jardin des Tuileries. She felt a hunger, long denied, for art. It was, after all, to study art history that she had chosen Paris for her semester abroad. But she had never really cared for the Louvre. It was too big, too mobbed with tourists, too overwhelming. Instead, she carried on a bit further, past the Pont Royal, to the Musée d'Orsay, where she had spent many memorable hours that long-ago spring, in the weeks before the bad thing destroyed her happiness and brought a premature ending to her stay. She turned into the Place Henri de Monterlin and was confronted by three massive bronze statues that had not been there in 1969. A rearing horse, a trumpeting elephant, a majestic rhinoceros. Though security at the museum's entrance was tight, the line of tourists waiting to get in was not that long, and Elizabeth waited her turn, presented her handbag for the guards to examine, passed through the arch of the metal detector, and purchased her ticket at the guichet. She spent the rest of the afternoon exploring the collection with a bliss she had feared she would be unable to feel, revisiting old friends, Van Gogh's portraits of Paul Gachet and Eugène Bosch and himself, Renoir's Bal du Moulin de la Galette, Manet's Olympia, and making the acquaintance of more recent acquisitions, Gauguin's Atahualpa vase, Mondrian's early Haystacks III, a set of stunning color autochromes photographed by the Lumiere brothers in the first decades of the 20th century. In the Café Campana, just past the Impressionist Gallery, she took a table beside the immense clock window overlooking the river and idled over an œuf poché and a pot of Grand Jasmine Chung Feng tea from Palais d'Été. Then, after her light lunch, she ascended to the top floor to see the Cezannes and Signacs, the Degas and Renoirs, the Manets and Monets. She took the elevator back down to the main level, grazed the temporary Paul Serruzier exhibit, bought a Van Gogh Iris's scarf for Kathleen, and a pair of bright water lily socks her son-in-law Jeffrey would enthuse over, but never wear, and a whimsical brooch inspired by François Pompon's iconic marble polar bear for herself in the shop. When the museum closed at 6 p.m., she was tired, but a friend from her book club in Falls Church had recommended the Restaurant Saint-Marc in the Rue de Verneuil and the map she had acquired at her hotel's reception desk showed her that it was practically right around the corner from the d'Orsay. So she walked and was fortunate to arrive early enough to get a table without a reservation. She dined on asparagus soup and a delicious turbot with lemon butter sauce, and drank a glass of Sauvignon Blanc, and was tempted to have a second glass, but, knowing what lay ahead, decided against it. She paid her bill and checked her map, and saw that the Université was only a short distance away. So again she walked. After retrieving her vial from her room and zipping it into an interior pocket of her handbag, she had Rino, who was back at the front desk, call her a taxi. It arrived quickly and took her, at her request, up to the base of the Funiculaire de Montmartre. She bought a round-trip ticket and rode the silver car up the steep incline to the end station, directly below Sacré-Cœur. From the gardens at the top of the steps, the city lay spread out below her. It was almost 8:30, and the sun had not yet quite set. The sight of the metropolis took her breath away. The white buildings with their slate-gray roofs, the Eiffel Tower standing proudly in the distance. As she stood there, streetlights began to flicker on. She caught a glimpse of Notre-Dame, its spire vanished, and her heart broke. She turned away and roamed the narrow streets of Montmartre, remembering. It was far more touristy than it had been when she was an innocent college student, every other storefront offering cliched souvenirs even at this hour, and of all things a Starbucks. Here, where there were cafes serving the heady French brew on every corner. But many things hadn't changed. The Parios Saint-Pierre was still there, one of the oldest churches in Paris, and Le Moulin de la Galette, of course, the windmill looking just as it had in 1876 when Auguste Renoir had painted it, a full century before her own time in the 18th arrondissement. Without once consulting her map, she made her way to the Rue Gabriel, number 45, its pale blue shutters looking as if they hadn't had a touch of paint since she had lived in a tiny room on the fourth floor, not really an apartment, but just a garret with a bed, a table, a chair, a wardrobe, a sink. The bathroom was down the hall, and she had shared it with four other girls. It was a squalid place, but it was in Montmartre, two doors down from Pablo Picasso's first Paris home at number 49, and to Elizabeth and the other students, it was charming and exciting and très joli. She rang the bell, hoping the current tenant might be at home, might allow her to mount the stairs and have a look, but there was no response. So she walked on, wondering if she could find Pascal's apartment, but sure she couldn't. She had only been there the one time, and she'd been so tipsy that night. She had simply followed along beside him, paying no attention to the twists and turns of the route. And even if she could somehow manage to stumble across it, she doubted she would recognize it. In any case, he surely hadn't lived there for decades, if in fact he was still alive at all. If not, of course, her entire trip would have been, no, not a waste. It had been lovely to revisit the d'Orsay, and perhaps tomorrow she would be able to get to Saint-Chapelle to marvel once again at the magnificence of its 1,100 panes of Gothic-stained glass, but a failure all the same. She remembered Au Clairon de Chasseur knew exactly where it was at the northeast corner of the Place du Tertre. The odds of anyone being able to help her were slim, but it was the only touchstone she had. If she could find no assistance there, she had no idea where else to look. She entered the square from the south, from the Place du Calvaire, and stepped carefully across the cobblestones. The tented cafes beneath the lindens, Les Sabots Rouges, Le Cremaillé 1900, Le Maire Catrin, were crowded with young couples holding hands, knots of students drinking pression and arguing politics, old men in berets and suspenders, sipping calvados and playing piquet. The Au Clairon had new awnings, she saw, blue and white stripes, and the wooden walls on either side of the open doorways had been painted the same rich shade of blue. There were two men behind the bar, a younger one in constant motion, quickly populating a metal tray with glasses of wine and beer and cocktails, and an older one standing by the sink, studiously drying a brandy snifter with a blue and white striped dishcloth. Elizabeth glanced around the cafe's interior. It was a pleasant spring evening, and most of the clientele were seated at the round marble tables that filled the narrow stone sidewalk outside. Indoors were only the pair of bartenders, an elderly couple gazing into each other's eyes like lovesick schoolchildren by one of the windows, and a slovenly old man in a far corner, hunched over a tumbler of milky white pastis, a lit cigarette sending a plume of white smoke ceilingward from a triangular Cinzano ashtray beside his glass. She approached the older of the two barmen and cleared her throat. "Parlez-vous anglais?" she asked. He nodded, not looking up, intent on his task. "I wonder if you can possibly help me," she said. She had rehearsed this speech hundreds of times over the last 50 years, could have delivered it in her sleep. "I'm looking for a man who used to come here most evenings long ago. Perhaps you knew him? His name was Pascal Durand." Still focused on the glass in his hands, the barman said, "He still does. He's in here almost every night." Elizabeth's heart skipped a beat. She hadn't realized she was holding her breath in anticipation of this response. She let out a sigh of relief. "I believe I'll have a glass of white wine and wait for him," she said.
"Wait for him? But madame is sitting right there, same as always."
He raised his chin in the direction of the old man in the corner.
"That's him?"
Elizabeth stared. "That can't be him," she said. "The man I'm looking for is young, not more than 25 or..." And then she realized the absurdity of what she was saying and cut herself off. She looked past the barman at the mirror hanging on the wall behind him. It was lined with bottles and glasses and an intricate silver espresso machine, but she was able to make out her own reflection amongst all those distractions. Gray hair pulled back in a bun, crow's feet etched into the skin at the corners of her eyes, a liver spot almost the size of a dime at the top of her left cheekbone. She was no longer the 22-year-old co-ed she had been that last night in Paris. She was half a century older now, 72, an old... no, not that, not yet, but an elderly woman. And obviously Pascal was no longer the handsome 25-year-old day laborer he had been once upon a time. "Merci," she said, and she walked across the wooden floor to the old man's corner table. He sat there with eyes downcast, staring into the soft yellow-white liquid in his glass, seemingly unaware of her presence. "Pascal," she said softly. "Pascal Durand." He reached for his cigarette and took a long drag, leaned his head back and exhaled a cloud of smoke. Then he looked at her, his pale blue eyes bleary. After what happened, after she'd left Paris early and returned home, Elizabeth had abandoned the study of art history. 4 hard years had passed, years that had challenged her in many ways, before she had felt able to return to school. And she had earned first an associate's degree in nursing, and then her RN, and had finally become a licensed practical nurse. She recognized in the old man's gaze the signs of open-angle glaucoma.
"Oh," he said at last, his voice hoarse with disuse. "Je suis Pascal Durand. Qui êtes-vous, madame?"
Elizabeth swallowed, turned back to the bartender, raised her hand to her mouth and swiveled her wrist.
"White wine," he called.
She nodded.
"May I sit down?" she asked,
hoping Durand had retained more of his English than she had of her textbook French. The old man blinked, confused.
"Here," he said, looking around the room at its many unoccupied tables. S'il vous plaît, she said.
He put his cigarette between his lips and waved gallantly at the wooden chair across from him. She sat, her handbag open on her lap.
I'm surprised smoking is still permitted indoors, she said, resorting to a banality to keep her voice from trembling. In America, we've forbidden it.
Yeah, true, he said, smiling a crooked smile.
Several of his teeth were missing, and those that remained were browned by decades of nicotine. He drew ostentatiously on his gitan and blew smoke toward the bar.
I'd like to see those bastards try to stop me.
A heavy silence fell between them. Elizabeth took a deep breath and found to her surprise that, now that the moment was here, she had gone icily calm.
You don't remember me, Pascal?
He leaned closer, peering at her.
Je suis désolé, madame, he said,
and then corrected himself and switched to English.
I am very sorry, but no.
The older barman appeared at her side, dropped a cardboard coaster onto the tabletop, and centered a stemmed glass upon it. She thanked him, and he gave Pascal an irritated look and went back to his station without a word. It was a very long time ago, Elizabeth said, and paused to take a sip of her wine. It was delicious, very dry, with undertones of passion fruit and peach.
I was much younger then, taller. I was pretty, I think, with long red hair I wore tied back in a yellow ribbon.
He shook his head.
My name, she said, hoping that this, at least, would jog his memory, is Elizabeth McIntyre. Lizzie I was back then.
He studied her intently, his gaze bleared by age and disease and drink, trying to see through the smoke of his cigarette the red-headed girl she had been half a century in the past.
Non, madame, he said. Je suis vraiment désolé.
She steeled herself for what was to come with a deeper draught of her wine.
We met here, she said, in this café, on a night much like tonight. I was with a group of girlfriends, and you joined us and bought us a round of drinks. When they left to go on to a party one of the boys was throwing, I stayed. You bought me more drinks, many more. I'd never had so much to drink in my life.
Nor since, she thought, but did not say. Not after what happened. Never again. He took a slow sip of his pastis and looked at her blankly. It was obvious that he had absolutely no memory of her whatsoever. But she had memories that still haunted her dreams, her nightmares, had haunted her for 50 years.
You got me very drunk, she said slowly, the words now coming in a staccato rhythm, like machine gun fire. You took me back to your apartment, and you raped me.
He said,
She realized that the word was one he didn't know, like Marie Claire and the bees. But this she could say in French. She had rehearsed the sentence again and again, preparing for this moment.
Tu m'as violé.
Moi,
he protested, as if such an act was unthinkable.
Vous vous trompez. You are not correct, madame.
I am quite correct, she said crisply. Tu m'as violé, Pascal. You may have forgotten, but I remember.
Without taking her eyes off him, she reached inside her handbag and found its zippered compartment by touch. She unzipped it and wrapped her hand around the small glass vial of crystals she had brought all the way from America.
The old man crushed out his gitan and stumbled to his feet, and at first she thought he was attempting to flee. But he headed not for the cafe doors, but for the toilets in the back of the bar.
Perfect. This was one part of her revenge she had been unable to pre-plan. How would she get him to ingest the poison? She looked down into the darkness of her bag and carefully worked the tiny stopper loose from the mouth of the vial. All she had to do now was pour the crystals into his glass. When he returned from the men's room, he would finish his drink, and his drink would finish him, and she would be free at last, of the memories that had held her captive for the entirety of her adult life. As she cautiously withdrew the open vial from the zippered compartment of her bag, her fingertips brushed a small envelope that shouldn't have been there. She took it out and saw that the word "Mom" had been scrawled upon it. She recognized the writing as Kathleen's. She opened the envelope and slid out a photograph of herself and her daughter, taken this past Christmas. Printed across it in black Sharpie was a message. "Have a wonderful trip, Mom. I'm so sorry I can't be there with you. I love you." The word "love" had been underlined 3 times, matching the 3 exclamation points. Kathleen must have slipped the envelope into her bag at the airport, perhaps as they had hugged each other goodbye at curbside. Elizabeth smiled at the smiles that wreathed their faces, mother and daughter, smiled a darker smile at the thought of what was soon to happen. She would empty her vial into Pascal's glass, and when he came back from the toilet, she would watch him drink it. She had chosen a poison that was completely tasteless, and it would be 20 minutes to half an hour before he began to feel its effects. By then, she would be gone, and no one would ever be able to tie his death to her. "At last," Elizabeth thought, "at last your father will pay for what he did to me." And in that instant, her blood froze. For all these years, she had only ever thought of Pascal Durand as her attacker, her assailant, her defiler. But it was true. This sorry old man she had traveled 6,000 miles to kill was in fact Kathleen's. She almost choked on the word. Was Kathleen's father. She had never considered him in that way, never once remembered him in terms of his relationship to her daughter. His daughter. Their daughter. She looked up from the picture and saw one last wisp of smoke curl upward from the stub of Pascal's cigarette. He had been gone for an unusually long time, she realized. Perhaps he was hiding from her. Perhaps it was a back way out of the cafe and he had vanished. If so, she knew she would never find him again. She took a final sip of her wine and set the empty glass back on its coaster and licked her dry lips. It doesn't matter, she thought. Not anymore. She returned her gaze to the picture, tenderly stroked the side of her daughter's, yes, her daughter's face with a steady fingertip. This is what matters. Only this. She would not do what she had come to Paris to do. But what she had accomplished with this trip, she realized, was something far more important. She had put her past where it belonged. In the past. She twisted the stopper back into the mouth of the little vial and replaced it in the zippered pocket of her handbag with the Christmas photo. She would have to find a way to get rid of the poison, a safe way, so that no one would accidentally be harmed by it. She could pour it out in the garden at the head of the funicular. But no, an innocent dog or cat might come along and lick up the crystals. A bee might mistake them for nectar. She took a 10-euro note from her bag and laid it on the table to pay for her wine. And then she left the Au Clairon de Chasseurs and walked back through the Rue de Montsigny and the Rue Azay to Sacré-Cœur. The basilica was still open, and she went inside. Though she was not religious, she lit a candle and said a private prayer before a statue of Saint-Denis with his head in his hands. When she came out of the Basilica of the Sacred Heart, she stood at the top of the steps and looked out at the view to the south. Night had fallen, and Paris was a fairyland of electric light. She was unable to pick out the cathedral, but she knew it was down there, minus its spire and forest, but somehow, miraculously, a survivor. She felt a strange kinship with Notre Dame, both of them old ladies who had almost been consumed by fire, each of them rescued at the last moment by some divine intervention. She cautiously descended the steps to the funicular station and waited for the car to arrive. It rattled to a stop at the top of its track, and its doors slid open. Elizabeth stepped aboard and settled herself on a hard plastic bench for the slow journey back down to the City of Light.
The City of Light is copyrighted by Josh Pachter. Music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing were done by Kevin Wheeler and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com.